That's right. That's what I need.
I've got him convinced.
Work on it for
you. Call the Rules Committee of Wednesday, March 11th to order. Quorum is present. We're going to start with Senator Champion, and I think we just have the bill. We have the subcommittee report from elections. So Senator Sieben moves the subcommittee report on Senate File 355. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
If you know, the motion prevails. Members, so now we're going to work from the CE1 document that you have in front of you. That is now the version of Senate File 355. Senator Champion.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It is my first time appearing in front of this committee, so thank you for having me. I'd like to start by, you know, thanking my co-authors, Senator Brandon Peterson, Senator Eaton, Senator Thompson, and Senator Chamberlain. And also, there's a clone bill that was also introduced, and that's Senate File 530, and that was introduced by Senators Hall, Latz, Engelbrightson, Benson, and Sinjum. What this bill does is really look at making some important changes to Minnesota Statute 609.165. And what that clearly says is that Minnesotans currently convicted of a felony cannot vote until they are discharged from probation or parole. All empirical data seems to suggest that here in Minnesota, we live in a wonderful state, but some of the probationary periods are very long. And so this legislation would allow Minnesotans to vote upon completion of incarceration when they are living in our community. They're paying taxes and contributing to society just like what is already done in 13 other states. And some of those other states that currently allow for someone to vote who's out and not incarcerated are like Hawaii, Illinois, Indiana, Massachusetts, Michigan, Montana, New Hampshire, North Dakota, Ohio, Oregon, Pennsylvania, Rhode Island, and Utah. And when we think about Minnesota, Mr. Chair, approximately 57,000 Minnesotans are unable to vote due to a felony conviction. And of that 57,000, approximately 47,000 are living in the community, and they come from all over the state. Most people are shocked when I give them the next statistic, which is that only 36% of the felonies are from Ramsey and Hennepin County. So of that 47,000, only 36% come from Hennepin and Ramsey County. And therefore, the remaining 64% are from outside of Hennepin and Ramsey County. So this is something that impacts all Minnesota. So approximately 33,000 are white, 9,000 are African American, 3,000 are Hispanic, and 3,000 are Native American. And when we think in terms of the current statute and the current law, there's no sound public policy reason to maintain Minnesota's policy of prohibiting people living in the community from voting. There's no evidence that it improves public safety or provides any other benefit. In fact, on the contrary, there's evidence that that by allowing people in the community to vote improves public safety. So there is a research link between pro-social activities like voting to a decrease in crime. And also, there's research that has shown that children are more likely to vote as adults if they are raised by parents who engage in the voting process. So this means the negative effect of felony disenfranchisement, I always have a problem with that word, on public safety and racial disparities described above will have a deeper and longer effect if maintained. So we also believe that the current policy confuses elections and has a significant financial cost. Of our current system is confusing and often leaves people wondering when and if they are eligible to vote. So allowing people to vote when they are not incarcerated will create a bright line, a rule, about who can vote. So I hope that you will join over 55 Minnesota organizations that also support it. I think you have in your packet a complete list that will articulate the number of supporters, a cross-section of supporters that we have here. And from the faith perspective, and I'll just name a few, include representations from all major traditions. They include the Minnesota Catholic Conference, Isaiah, and the Minnesota Council of Churches, Jewish Community Action, Muslims, the Joint Religious Legislative Coalition. And from a public safety and legal perspective. Supporters include but not limited to criminal defense attorneys, as well as reentry focus groups such as corrections professionals represented by the Minnesota Community Corrections Association. And last but certainly not least, there's also a great representation from the Minnesota County Attorneys Association, as well as other direct service and advocacy groups, both civic and good government groups like the NAACP. So I want to thank those organizations that are articulated in your package, but also those that I just mentioned, and many others working to change our current law. And I just sincerely appreciate their hard work. So that's the bill, Mr. Chair, and I'll be happy to stand for any questions.
Senator Hamm.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Senator Champion. Just a question of clarification. I'm looking at page 2, lines 17 and 18, 2.1718. It changes the language to say that the restoration of the right to vote doesn't occur when the sentence has been completed, but only the incarceration. And you made the comment that our probationary periods are very long. Does that suggest, or is that true then, that the incarceration periods in Minnesota are very short compared to other places?
Mr. Chair and Senator, I'm not making that suggestion at all. I think that we leave that work up to the sentencing guideline folks and all the other folks. What I am saying is that if an individual is out and they're in our communities and they're paying taxes and they are abiding by our laws, which they have to do. If a person is out on probation, there are conditions and they have to adhere to those conditions, that we believe that it just makes good sound policy, public policy, for them to be able to vote.
Any other questions? Senator Metzen moves.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Sway.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Gazalka and I are in the tax committee, and he wanted to be here to vote on this. Can we get somebody to? I just sent somebody. If we could, he'll be here in just a few minutes.
Okay.
If we could hold on.
So you need to fill in. So start talking.
I don't have anything to say. So.
Never stopped you before, right?
Well, I'm used to saying things that don't mean anything.
That's listen, Steve. $2. Enough. Unity, you gonna need more now?
A special one. I've got one of these, I think. $2.
This is actually legitimate. This is legitimate.
Oh yeah.
I thought you were handing me one. It's only kidney, man.
That's the first one you ever made.
We had a good deal. Bucks for one.
Yeah, but you weren't quick enough.
Good job. I could say something, Jason. Michael. All right.
Mr. Chairman, where Senator Limmer and I are trying to think of some good jokes that we could tell.
Senator Sequoia, what's the tax committee doing this morning?
We are debating a 529 college saving plan, and Senator Gazalka is offering an amendment to broaden the scope of that to include saving plans around the country as opposed to just the Minnesota plan. Having a conversation about the rate of return that these plans are giving back to the savers.
In other places.
And if there's, and it's kind of moving into a conversation about why the Minnesota plan's returns are lagging over other states' plans. And it might be leaving the realm of the tax committee a little bit, but it is an interesting conversation they're having, and he's very involved in it with Senator Clausen.
What does it cost?
Well, the bill as introduced costs around $9 million. It doesn't cost anything. Well, it costs a little bit to expand it out to outside the Minnesota plan. It's all scalable. So, you know, good conversation going on. It's part of the conversation, yeah, which whether Minnesota would have a credit.
Yeah. Just got a message from Senator Gazelka saying not to wait for it. So Senator Metzen moves Senate File 355 be amended, as amended, be recommended to pass. Any other discussion? All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Contrary, no?
No.
The motion prevails.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Senator Sieben, Senate File 455. We just got the report from the Senate.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And committee.
Senator Sieben moves adoption of the subcommittee report. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Contrary, no. Motion prevails.
So, Mr. Chair and members, this is the elections omnibus bill that's before you. It may seem a little bit early for the whole bill to be coming through the Rules Committee, but it does have to make a number of other stops and in order to meet the policy deadline. We're trying to get it moving here. So as you can see, it's a long, there are five articles. I will try to briefly explain each of them, but if you have specific questions, I'm obviously open to more discussion. So Article 1 contains a variety of election administration provisions. Section 1 ensures that when a school board moves from a 7-member to a 6-member board, 3 members will be up for election at a time instead of, as is the current case, where there's a 2-member election 1 year and then a 4-member election the following year. Section 2 requires a school board to hold a special election if more than 1 year remains on a term. This is a provision that is a compromise language between Senators Bonhoff, Kiffmeyer, and myself that I can explain more if you'd like to hear, but essentially what it's doing is requiring a special election if there's more than a year left on a board member's term. Sections 4 and 5 of Article 1 specify that when a party files a petition to become a major or minor party, those signatures must be collected in the year the petition was filed. Section 6 and 7 provide a definition for partisan and nonpartisan office. Section 8 removes obsolete language. Section 9 is a Senator Herr bill that relates to uniform and overseas absentee voting. So it allows National Guard members to use UACAVA voting procedures. And it allows for children who are born abroad, two parents that were at one point, that were most recently Minnesota residents, to allow those children to vote the Minnesota federal ballot. Sections 10 to 13 are from an administration bill, so it changes the reference from cassette tape to audio file. Section 11 allows voters to return their own absentee ballot on election day. Prior to the introduction of no-excuse absentee voting, if a voter wanted to return their ballot, he or she had to use an agent to deliver it. So this allows the voter to return their ballot directly. Section 12 allows ballots returned by FedEx or other package delivery service to be accepted after the last U.S. mail delivery but before 8 p.m. on election day. And 8 p.m. was chosen to coincide with the time at which polls close. Section 13 allows absentee ballot boards to compare the numbers on the absentee ballot return envelope to either the application or their voter record. So, for instance, what can happen right now and is happening in some cases is a voter will put their last 4 digits of their Social Security number And then when they, on their on their voter registration card, and then that doesn't line up with their voter application form, and so then their ballots are being rejected because those two numbers don't match up, even though the election officials have both numbers in the, in the system. Section 14 deletes an obsolete cross-reference. Section 15 provides that children who haven't resided in the U.S. may vote if their parent maintained residence in Minnesota previously and they meet other eligibility requirements. Section 16 deletes language that states that a Social Security number qualifies as a person's military ID number. This language is no longer needed because military members are not required to use their Social Security number on their absentee ballot applications. Section 17 is a conforming change. 18 allows individuals that already have statutorily protected addresses to omit their address on the public portion of the affidavit of candidacy. Section 19 allows students to serve as election judges in counties other than the county where they reside. Section 20 removes the requirement that the name of each candidate be printed in all capital letters. There's some testimony about how now it's easier for people to read uppercase and lowercase letters as opposed to all uppercase. Sections 21, 22, 28, 31 to 34, 46 to 51 are, again, all from the admin bill. They remove references to voters placing an X or a square in our current, and instead accommodates our current optical scan balloting system where you can color in an oval. And changes also in these sections allow the words yes and no to be written in upper and lower case. Section 23 ensures that titles for judges, again, can be printed in upper and lower case. Section 24 is Senator Eakin's bill to allow mail balloting to more small cities. It increases the cap on the number of registered voters from 400 to 1,000 people. This is only for cities located outside the metropolitan area. Sections 25 to 29 are from the admin bill. Again, it conforms a timeline for processing mail ballots with absentee ballots. Section 26 clarifies the right to take time off of work applies to all regularly scheduled federal, state, county, and city elections. Section 27 removes the requirement that voters fold their ballots before putting them in the ballot box. 29 removes a requirement that a voter hand the ballot to an election judge who then inserts it into the ballot box, because now voters directly feed their ballots into the ballot box themselves. Section 30 is another Senator Herr bill. It allows it removes the cap on the number of people that who can receive assistance at the polls. So right now, Minnesota has a number in place that voters can receive assistance. That an individual can assist six people in marking a ballot or helping with translation services. And there's only one other state besides Minnesota in the country that puts this arbitrary limit on the number of voters someone can assist. So the language today removes that cap. Sections 35 and 37 clarifies that a request for a recount must be submitted by 5 o'clock on the last day for requesting a recount. Sections 36 and 38 ensure that in the case of a discretionary recount in a primary, the process for preparing the general election ballots isn't delayed and requires the canvassing board to certify the results of a recount as soon as possible. Section 39 ensures that a contest cannot be used to delay the issuance of an election certificate. We had a lot of discussion about this in committee, but it was not a controversial thing. Section 40, again, deletes a cross-reference. 40, Section 41 conforms the administrative practice of delivering an election certificate in the case of a special election to that of a regular election. Section 42 removes a requirement that instructions, again, be printed in all capital letters. 43 to 45 removes unneeded language in statute. 52 contains the Election Emergency Planning Task Force. This is a bill that I authored, and it creates a task force of various stakeholders to bring to discuss and make recommendations to the legislature related to emergency planning for elections. Moving on to, and then there are some provisions that are repealed in Section 53. Moving on to Article 2, Senator Eakin had a bill to for Uniform Presidential Electors Act. So it's what this does, it develops a more comprehensive process for alternate electors when that presidential elector process takes place. Article 3 relates to voter registration. There's a Senator Carlson provision in the in this that would allow 16 and 17-year-olds the opportunity to pre-register to vote. And then there's another provision in here that is something that I authored that would automatically register, pre-register or register individuals when they sign up or renew their driver's license or state ID. Right now we have an opt-in system. If you remember, when you fill out your driver's license, you can check a box to update your voter registration. This would turn that opt-in process into an opt-out process. Article 4 is Senator Champion's restoration of voting rights for those who have been convicted of a felony. It's the same language that we just discussed. Article 5 is early voting. We've had this proposal before us previously, but this language provides a 12-day window beginning 15 days before the election and ending the third day before the election for individuals to vote early. If you recall, we passed no excuse absentee voting in the last biennium, and we saw a tremendous increase in the number of Minnesotans who are choosing to vote in person or no excuse absentee. What we've heard from local election officials is that process is not only more cumbersome than casting a regular ballot, but it's also more expensive to administer. So this would institute an early voting period, again, for 15 days starting before the election. Article 6 is a redistricting change. Senator Hayden brought a bill forward that right now in Minnesota, individuals who are incarcerated are counted counted at the location where they're incarcerated during the census. If you think that through, it means that those districts are getting larger representation than other people, since those individuals who are incarcerated can't vote. So this change would put into practice would put us more in practice with our state constitution, which says that, in part, for the purpose of voting, no person loses residence solely by reason of his absence, and then goes on to say, while confined in any public prison. And then Article 7 is just the appropriations provision. So with that, Mr. Chia, that was a pretty quick summary, but I'm happy to stand for questions on any section of it.
Senator Hand.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator Stephen, just a couple of questions. Trying to make sure I understand all the things in this bill. In Article 3, you talked about being a provision to allow people who are under 18 but at least 16 to register to vote. What is the purpose to do that? Wouldn't that create some confusion, potentially, of people who have registered believing that they could vote and put an additional burden on people at a voting booth to determine whether or not the person registered is actually eligible to vote? In the past, if you were registered, you were eligible. This would seem to suggest that you can be registered but not eligible. What is the logic to do that?
Mr. Chair and Senator Hahn, we heard testimony from a variety of people who saw, first of all, that allowing students, or in this case 16 or 17-year-olds, to pre-register to vote actually increased their voter participation rate when they turned 18. So it does not make an individual eligible to vote. Obviously, we're not changing the voting age. But the actual process of allowing people to pre-register has been shown in other states to increase those young people's participation when they turn 18. It must be because registering to vote in some ways is a burden for young people. And as I said, we did get some pretty good testimony from young people who did some research and looked at other states where, for instance, when you get your driver's license, then a lot of students get their driver's license when they turn 16. If they could pre-register to vote, then that's already set in place and ready to go when they turn 18. So it just seemed like a good thing to do that will, as you may or may not know, our young people have the lowest voter participation rate of any other age category, and this seemed to be one small step that we could do to try to engage them more in the electoral process.
Senator Hahn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Senator Siebenite. All that notwithstanding, what is the process going to be at the poll then? Because at least in the past, when you go to the poll, they have a list of all the registered voters, and you go in and you give your name, and they see if you're on the list, and if you're on the list, they give you a ballot. Now you're going to be on the list potentially, but you're not going to be eligible to vote. How is the polling station going to know which registered voters are permitted to vote and which are not? Is there going to be another level of administrative work that needs to be done to determine that, or how does that work?
Mr. Chair and Senator Hahn, the 16 and 17-year-olds don't show up on the voter polls that are, or the voter roster, until they're eligible to vote. So in other words, they're registered into the statewide voter registration system, but they're not eligible to vote or showing up on the voter polls until they're eligible when they turn 18.
And Mr. Chair and Senator Sieben, that's what I'm trying to get at. In the past, if you have registered to vote, you are eligible to vote. Now we're saying you can be registered to vote and not eligible to vote, and somebody's going to have to decide who the eligible voters are among the registered voters. And I'm trying to understand how that's going to work.
Mr. Chair, Julie Struther from the Office of the Secretary of State can take a stab at this, too.
Welcome to the committee. Your name for the record.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Julie Struther with the Office of the Minnesota Secretary of State. Let me know if this doesn't answer your question, but right now the Secretary of State's office and under current law can already pre-register folks if they will be 18 by the next general election. And the way the statewide voter registration system works is that their information is entered into the system, but they're in a pending status until their 18th birthday. So they don't show up on the voter rolls. They don't show up on the public information list until they turn 18. And so this would essentially set a bright line of 16 for those folks when they can submit their registration application, but they're not registered and don't show up on the voter rolls until they turn 18.
Peter keeps track.
Peter keeps track.
Short answer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Pappas is clarifying. She says the computer keeps track, so I just wanted to understand that's what happens. So thank you for that. And Senator Limmer acknowledges that he's now comforted by that. And Senator Sieben, if I may, Mr. Chairman, a question on different article, Article 6, that you described as changing how we account for people who are, I think what you're saying is that people who are incarcerated in a facility would not be counted for purposes of determining representation, but they would be sort of counted in wherever their last known address was. And I'm trying to understand the logic of that, too. We have a lot of people for various reasons who are not eligible to vote, but we still count them for purposes of representation. For example, children, people under the age of 18, are not permitted to vote, but they live in different numbers in different places in the state, but we count them for purposes of representation. Why wouldn't we count the people who reside in that district, even if they're incarcerated? What is the logic to separate them out?
Mr. Chair and Senator Hand, we're still counting the people who are incarcerated, but now instead of counting them at the location where they're incarcerated, they would be counted at their last known residential address. And the as I said in my remarks, there is a provision in under Article 7 of the Minnesota Constitution that says that for purposes of voting, no person loses residence solely by reason of his absence while confined in any public prison. And so, you know, I think that this this is actually putting us more in line with our state constitution, and it's just there's the people will still be counted. It's just an alternative and perhaps more fair way of counting them or accounting for where they're from.
And thank you, Senator Stephen. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator Stephen, another question related to this. Do we then need to adjust how we account for college students? Should they have their residence be established at their last known residence, or should their residence be counted in the college they attend for purposes of representation? It seems to me that it's very likely that students who attend college are counted in their home district as part of the population for representation, but they vote in the district they attend school at. So doesn't this present the same kind of conflict as what you're trying to address in Article 6?
Mr. Chair, I don't think that it's the same, but you raise a good point. Students right now, as you know, have a choice of where they want to register to vote and where they vote from, either from their address at school or their home address. And but this isn't addressing that at all. This is, for the purpose of the census, just talking about those people who are incarcerated.
And Mr. Chair and Senator Sieben, I appreciate that, but I think typically if during the census, the students are counted in the district where they live, not where they attend school. But what you're saying is that there ought to be a match between where you live and where you are counted as part of the represented population, and it doesn't seem to be applied with college students, but it would be applied in this case. I think if you're going to do this, I think there might be an effort to make some consistency in how you deal with that.
Senator Kwan.
Mr. Chairman, I'm not going to rail against the bill relative to one of the articles. I'd raised this in the subcommittee, but I do want to point out in Article 2, Uniform Faithful Presidential Electors Act, I really have some serious reservations as to whether or not we can actually do that. And let me just explain what this is all about, if I'm not mistaken, Senator Sieben. In 2004, during the Bush-Kerry election, there was a Minnesota elector who made a mistake. And instead of voting for John Kerry for president, who had won the state, that elector voted for John Edwards, who was the vice presidential candidate. And so there was a lot of talk about that. Now, ultimately, it didn't make any difference in the election because I asked one of the staff just to check on a couple of the numbers. I think the Electoral College has been reported as 286 to 252, although, again, there was one Minnesota elector who actually voted for John Edwards. So what Article 2 attempts to do is to provide some protection against a mistake like that by establishing electors and alternates. There is no provision in the U.S. Constitution for the selection or election of alternate electors. The Constitution gives states the authority to select electors, but there is no mention of alternates. The discussion in the subcommittee was, but the Constitution gives the state permission to select electors. And certainly states, there are two states in the country that have done things a little bit differently. Maine and Nebraska establish electoral votes where there is a vote for each congressional district as to which candidate wins the congressional district, plus two at-large electors. So in 2012, for instance, in 2008, President Obama got a single vote out of Nebraska because he won the Omaha congressional district. But there's no provision for alternates. So you could have a hypothetical, I would argue, and I was trying to do it with the numbers of the 2004 election where this did happen, and it doesn't really work, that John Kerry lost the election by virtue of losing the state of Ohio, which was moderately close, closer than it was in 2000. That was 20 votes. So if George Bush had not had those 20 votes, he would have had 266 electoral votes. Kerry would have had 272 electoral votes and been elected president. What would have happened, however, if you could have found a state, and I can't think of the state, of either three or four electoral votes that have been very close, and you'd found a situation where maybe you had George Bush with 269 electoral votes, and because of Minnesota, John Kerry with 268 electoral votes. And we saw what happened with the confusion over the Bush v. Gore U.S. Supreme Court case in 2000. We would have had an equal confusing Supreme Court determination if you'd had a 269 to 268 to one kind of situation. So I understand what this is supposed to do. I'm not going to vote against the bill because of it. I think it kind of possibly fits into the, you know, how many angels fit on the head of the pin kind of argument, because you'd have to come up with the very, you know, the exact set of arithmetic. But I don't think we have the ability to do this. I don't think anybody in this room can name a Supreme Court decision that would allow for the establishment of alternate electors. And that's the key. The Constitution gives all authority to the states to determine the selection of electors and how the electors are to proceed. The other unusual election, obviously 2000 was a very unusual election. Probably the other unusual election in American history was 1824, which was the one that went to the House of Representatives. I'm not aware of any Supreme Court challenge to what happened with that determination, where John Quincy Adams, who actually had less votes, was elected by virtue of the House election, because that did follow the House election. Our election in American history probably was 1800, where there was a tie. It was 1800 or 1804. Well, there's a tie between Thomas Jefferson and Aaron Burr, because each, Sir Limmer's telling me 1804, because each elector voted for the two candidates on that ballot, and that election also went to the House. So these situations tend to be pretty obscure in American history, but again, I'll suggest, unless somebody can inform me of a U.S. Supreme Court decision that allows for the establishment of alternate electors, I don't think we can do it.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Steven.
And Senator Cohen, we already have alternate electors in Minnesota right now under the current statute. So this is actually just making some changes to how they align. So we already have alternates right now. And
Mr. President, Mr. Chairman, and Senator Steven, I know that. And I think someday somebody could challenge that part of the statute if it ever resulted in an election that was a 269, 269, 270, 268 electoral college determination, and that particular elector was the elector in question. There's never been a Supreme Court determination relative to the establishment of alternate electors. And simply because it exists in present state law doesn't make it constitutional.
Senator Stubb.
thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator Steven, what in the repealers on under Article 1, could you just expand why or how the repealing of the use of physical boundaries, what was the rationale with that? And does it, I can't really tell and I didn't look it up, but does that just apply to school board elections or does that apply to others?
Mr. Chair, and maybe Ms. Strother could help me. It was something about how, yeah, she can explain it better.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, this was a request from the League of Minnesota Cities. Right now, precinct boundaries that the cities draw are required to follow physical features, but school district boundaries are not. And so what cities are dealing with is often a case where a precinct will have the vast majority of their voters in one school district, but they'll have maybe a small handful of voters in another school district. But because of the requirement that the precinct boundaries follow physical boundaries, they're not able to adjust their precinct to meet the school district line, which causes confusion in the polling place. It means they have, you know, 98% of the people voting one ballot but having to make sure that they get the other, 2% of the people going into that polling place voting the other. So it's allowing them to adjust their precinct boundaries to meet the school district boundary lines.
Senator Newman.
Senator Sieben, I want to ask you a question regarding Article 3 and Article 5. First of all, in Article 3, allowing the high school students to pre-register before they're 18 years old, I can honestly see where that might be a good idea. I know at that age, when you're in schools talking to high school kids, they get pretty excited about the idea of voting and so forth. But there's also a part of me that thinks that sometimes high school students don't make the best choices all the time. I could see a situation where either by reason of, say, a high school prank, or maybe because a high school student is really passionate about a single issue, they might get out and try to vote. Can you assure me there is a bright line drawn that differentiates the pre-registration from the registration so that a high school student is not going to be making some pretty significant mistake by trying to vote when they're not eligible, just because they're young and maybe not making a real good choice? Is there that bright line?
Well, Mr. Chair and Senator Newman, as you know, when a precinct gets its list of registered voters, the pre-registered voter who is still 16 or 17 years old and not yet eligible to vote will not be on that list of eligible voters. So, I think that's a pretty clear indication, a clear line between they won't be listed as a registered voter. And so,
and Mr. Chair, Senator Stevens, that would be the firewall that you're putting up and relying on so that they wouldn't vote. Is that correct?
Correct. And Mr. Chair and Senator Newman, you'll recall that now, as was mentioned earlier, people can pre-register to vote if they're going to be 18 by the next general election. But if they're eligible, if they're not eligible before for another election, like say a primary, they could still be registered, but yet not eligible. So I think we already have a system in place that does demarcate clearly that line between who's registered and who's not. That's served us well, and this is just bumping that back further. So it's extending the time when the person would be eligible just to register.
Okay, Mr. Chair.
Senator Newman, any further?
And then Senator Sieben on Article 5, that's the early voting article. Folks that I talk to at home, at least in the rural area, pretty popular idea. Candidly, I will tell you that just from a nostalgic standpoint, I kind of hate to see us lose the excitement of Election Day, but I don't know that that's a good reason to say no to a system. I think people do like it. But explain to me what you have in place that will protect the integrity of the voting when we are going to allow people to vote early rather than by way of absentee or, on election day. What integrity have you got built into this system to protect us?
So, Mr. Chair and Senator Newman, as you know right now, if a person casts an in-person absentee ballot because of either the change that was made in the previous election where now they don't need to provide an excuse to vote early, they're still casting an absentee ballot. So when they show up to your county, for instance, to vote early, up to 46 days before the election, as is the current case for absentee voting, you fill out a voter registration or absentee ballot application, have that signed by the witness, give it to the administrator, and then that person gives you a ballot to vote. So you cast your ballot, and then you give it back to the administrator, who then doesn't feed it into a vote counter, but instead places it in a secure area for the absentee ballot board to then process. So what I think what's happening now in Minnesota is Minnesotans, either because of our political parties advertising it this way or elected officials saying go vote early, Minnesotans think we have early voting right now, but really what we have is this bifurcated system where you can show up and cast an absentee ballot early, but it's not an actual ballot. And so I go through and explain that, or I tried to explain it more clearly just to show that what we've seen and what election officials, and I think this is why local election officials so strongly support early voting, the counties and the cities, for example, is because if you could show up at your same election spot up to 15 days before the election, only up until the third day before, the Saturday before, and cast a regular ballot, then you're getting your voting just like you would on election day. Regarding the process of having of still having election day, that will be up for individual voters to choose whether they want to vote on election day, the Tuesday, or early. But one thing that that early voting does change too is, if you recall from being on the subcommittee, if you cast an absentee ballot and later want to change your mind and not have it counted and then vote on election day, you could still do that. This will change that. So if you vote early a week before, for instance, your voting is done. You can't change your mind and then go back and take your ballot later. So I actually think that not only is this more cost-effective for local units of government to administer, but there are provisions that are built in place just by not having an absentee ballot board and going through all that signature, well, not getting the signature and having a witness and comparing the numbers, that will make an early voting process, there'll be more integrity in the system.
And Senator Sieben, so this is in-person voting. It's not voting by mail, correct?
Correct.
And Senator Sieben, then the place where the voter is going to show up to vote early, is it going to be, say, at a county auditor's office? I mean, not all the precincts are going to be open. So where's the person or the voter going to go to exercise this early voting?
Mr. Chair and Senator Newman, it would be the place where the person can cast a no-excuse absentee ballot in person, so like a county auditor's office or a city election office in some cases. Or there's a provision in the language, too, that allows for counties to establish vote centers if they would like to do that. So, for instance, if Hennepin County wants to have more than their normal locations, they could go through a normal process and have vote centers.
Thank you, Senator Sieben.
Senator Zelka.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Sieben, along those lines, so if this becomes law and then we take Article 1, Section 30, where there's no limit to the number of people that you can assist, then you could bring busloads of people in early to vote?
Well, Mr. Chair and Senator Gazelka, the voter assistance provision is used for cases where people may not may need help with translation services, or perhaps they have a physical disability that makes it difficult for them to mark a ballot themselves. So this provision would allow for those individuals who are able to provide translation services to translate a ballot for a voter. Right now in Minnesota statute, and there's nothing that would change that, there's a prohibition, and it's against the law, to tell someone how to vote or to attempt to influence them while they're helping someone, if they're helping someone with translation services, for example. A voter also has the opportunity under current law to have an election judge from both party be there to help them. But as we heard in committee, there are cases where Senator Herr was very articulate in saying that if he was helping elderly people, for instance, from his community who trust him, who know him, to help them translate a ballot to vote, there's this arbitrary cap where he literally was choosing and he was choosing between which relatives in his clan he could help assist to translate, and then there's this cap, and then he couldn't assist other people after that cap that's in statute. And as I said earlier, only Arkansas that we could find and that NCSL could find has kind of this arbitrary cap put on to that limits the number of people someone can assist, can help vote or help translation or with their physical disability.
Mr. Chair, Senator Stevens, so maybe, you know, maybe we have something related to relatives or whatever, but you'd mentioned only one other place, but how many states require photo ID? Because if you have that requirement and then bring in a lot of people, you know, that's a different way of doing it. We don't have photo ID, so how do they show who they are then?
Well, Mr. Chair and Senator Gazelka, Ms. Struther could articulate the what documents a person can present when they're registering to vote or if they're registering to vote on election day. But nothing in this bill would allow for photo ID, you're correct, or would require a photo identification. But this, again, isn't questioning whether a person is eligible to vote or not. That's already been established when the person checks in, for example. So this is if the person needs assistance with marking their ballot, not in determining whether or not they're eligible to vote.
Senator Newman.
Senator Stevens, is there anything in the bill that changes the current law on vouching, which I believe is 8, if I'm not mistaken?
Mr. Chair and Senator Newman, no.
Senator Ann.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Senator Stevens. Just in the course of the discussion and going back to what we were talking about previously about being able to register at age 16, would a 16-year-old be allowed to go to the poll and register at the poll on election day for an election in which they were not going to vote? In other words, they're 16, it's an election day, they want to register to vote, so they go to the poll on election day and register. Could they do that?
Mr. Chair, Senator Han, if there were voter registration cards at the election place, I assume, then that person would be, could fill out a card. But Ms. Struther can add more information.
Mr. Chair, Senator, I think if, for example, a 16-year-old went with their parent as their parent was voting, they could, if there was a voter registration card, pick up the registration card and submit it, but it wouldn't be a same-day election registration like you would if you were newly 18 and showing up the polls and wanting to register for that election. So they would be able to fill out the card, hypothetically, if they were able to be in the polling place. There's rules about who gets to be in the polling place, and I think if they go with their parent, they're able to be in the polling place as a 16-year-old. But I think the only situation I can imagine is if they went in with their parent, maybe, you know, like children do with their parents, filled out the card, but it wouldn't be registration for that election. It would be just submitting a registration, like if they had submitted it the day after the election.
Well, Mr. Chair, and thank you, but I think that kind of, we permit same-day registration to vote, and it's presumed that when you register, you're eligible. So if you're doing it at a polling place on the day of an election, the presumption is that you're eligible to vote. That's currently what happens, I believe. If we now say that you can do that and not be eligible to vote, how will the people there know that this is a 16-year-old not eligible to vote or an 18-year-old who is? Would they be required to show a photo ID, or how is that going to happen?
Mr. Chair and Senator Hamm, because they provide their birth date. And if they're not 18, their birth date would not make them, they would not be old enough to vote. And there's also an oath that they sign that certifies that they're swearing that they are an eligible voter, 18 years old.
Any other questions, members? Okay. Any other questions, members? Senator Sieben, I believe, I don't know what all committees have asked for this, but it'd be transportation has. Where would you like to go next?
Next to transportation, please.
Okay. Senator Sieben moves that Senate File 455, as amended, be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Transportation. Any other questions, members? All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Contrary, no.
No.
Motion prevails.
Mr. Chairman, before we go on to the next bill, I just wanted to revert back to the Senate File 355, Senator Champion's bill that we acted on earlier, and I've been told that we may need to revise that motion that we voted on to perhaps consider sending this bill to the Finance Committee. There is a fiscal note that it was attached to a very, very similar bill that Senator Moy had in 2010 or 9 that did have a fiscal note attached. I've got a copy of it, but and I see Senator Cohen is not here, but it may be that this would have a fiscal impact that should be addressed. Oh, yeah, there he is. Senator Cohen is here.
Senator Cohen.
Well, Mr. Chairman, Senator Hand, if the bills come into the Finance Committee, there'd have to be a fiscal note attached, or at least some explanation as to why there's not a fiscal note. And until it gets there, the responsibility is not until it gets to the Finance Committee.
And Mr. Chair, and Sarah Cohen, I guess I'm kind of raising that because there is a fiscal note that was attached to the previous bill, but not to Senator Champion's bill. So I'm just wondering if we need to review that and amend our motion to send it to Finance Committee and request a fiscal note.
Yeah, and I wasn't quite sure because I got here a few minutes late, so I didn't. I wasn't here for that discussion. If there is a fiscal note, then it should come to the Finance Committee.
Senator Hand, I think let's have staff take a look at that, and if the bill resides on general orders and it does have a fiscal note, I will personally support taking it off general orders and sending it back to Finance.
And Mr. Chairman, Senator Hand, you know, that happens a few times a year, as you know, that we'll have a bill that comes to the floor.
He hasn't heard it for a while.
And we didn't catch the fiscal note either initially or it was prepared late, and then we always send it back to the Finance Committee.
No, I'm not going to give it.
Senator Pappas has Senate File 113. Senator Pappas.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. What I have before you today is a resolution memorializing Congress to remove the deadline for ratification of the Equal Rights Amendment by the state. The 14th Amendment's Equal Protection Clause has not been interpreted to guarantee equal rights on the basis of gender in the same way as an Equal Rights Amendment would. In fact, in a recent case, Justice Scalia, when asked why he voted against the Lilly Ledbetter petition, and this was Lilly Ledbetter trained a employee who then received a higher salary than her, and she didn't find out about it until she retired. But Justice Scalia said that the Constitution does not prohibit discrimination based on sex, thus I was under no constitutional obligation to do so. So therefore, in the Ledbetter case, the statute of limitations came into play and her case was dismissed. So the principle of gender equality is contained in the Charter of the UN, the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, and all subsequent major international human rights instruments, including the CEDAW, Convention on the Elimination of All Forms of Discrimination Against Women. The language in the Equal Rights Amendment was first proposed in 1923 by Alice Paul, who was the founder of the National Women's Party. It was finally passed by Congress in 1972 and ratified by 35 of 38 states necessary for its inclusion in the Constitution. And even though Article 5 of the Constitution imposes no time limit, there was a time limit in the proposing clause of the Equal Rights Amendment. Congress did extend the time limit once from 1978 to 1982, but there still fell three states short. So this This, and also the Equal Rights Amendment, was ratified by the legislature of the state of Minnesota on February 12, 1973. So this proposal is to urge Congress to remove the deadline so that three more states could choose to ratify the Equal Rights Amendment. That's what we're doing. Questions?
Any questions, members?
Then, Mr. Chairman, I would move Senate File 113.
Senator Pappas moves Senate File 113 be recommended to pass. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Contrary, no.
No.
Motion prevails.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Members, I think that concludes the business in front of the Rules Committee. This committee is adjourned.